Welcome to the Daily Stoic Podcast, where each weekday we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, a short passage of ancient wisdom designed to help you find strength and insight here in everyday life. And on Wednesdays, we talk to some of our fellow students of ancient philosophy, well-known and obscure, fascinating and powerful. With them, we discuss the strategies and habits that have helped them become who they are, and also to find peace and wisdom in their actual lives. But first, we've got a quick message from one of our sponsors. Hey, it's Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. I try to have this show be a mix of academics, of experts, of doers, of athletes, people I know, people whose work I admire. I always try to bring you someone who I think has a unique perspective. And my guest today, Massimo Pigliucci, is someone I've known for quite some time. I've had dinner in his house. He invited us all to a little pre-StoicCon party. I guess this would have been in 2016. He was the host of StoicCon in New York City, which is a conference every year about Stoicism. You may be familiar with Massimo's work. He wrote a very viral piece called How to Be a Stoic in the New York Times several years ago. He wrote a great book by the same title called How to Be a Stoic, Using Ancient Philosophy to Live a Modern Life, which is largely about Epictetus. He also has one called A Handbook for New Stoics, How to Thrive in a World Out of Your Control. And his new book we're going to talk about is called The Quest for Character, What the Story of Socrates and Alcibiades Teaches Us About Our Search for Good Leaders. Alcibiades is a fascinating historical character, as we get into in today's episode. It's sort of a best and the brightest kind of situation. He had all the promise and talent in the world, and then it goes so poorly. No one, I think, is more well-suited to discuss this than Massimo. He is a professor of philosophy at the City College of New York. He's the former co-host of the Rationally Speaking podcast, and just an interesting expert on skepticism, pseudoscience, and then personally fell in love with philosophy. He's has this interesting sort of personal belief. He fuses stoicism and skepticism. Neo-skepticism is one thing he's called it, he says, which uses the combined insights of the ancient skeptics and stoics to craft a better way to think and live one's life. His new book, The Quest for Character, What the Story of Socrates and Alcibiades Teaches Us About Our Search for Good Leaders, is really interesting. I think you're going to like it. And thanks to Massimo for coming on the podcast. I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next to listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. All right, well, let's kick this off with a pronunciation guide. How do you say his name? Is it Alcibiades? Alcibiades? I'm embarrassed to say I don't know exactly.
I'd say Alcibiades, although that's an anglicized translation, you know, version of the name. So it's okay. Either way, I don't think he minds. Let's put it that way.
Yes, well, he's definitely dead, and the Stoics would say it doesn't quite matter. But I struggle with that myself because obviously you interact with the words in the classroom, and so do your students. But so much of the philosophy that I've learned, the books that I've read, I read by myself. I've never heard any of the words said by anyone. Sometimes it's not until I come to interview them for the podcast or I'm saying them in public, I realize I may have been like butchering the pronunciation, which is partly why I'm super patient when someone comes up to me and talks about Stoicism or something like that. Like, I get where they're coming from, and also it doesn't really matter.
That's right, exactly. And of course, the other thing is, even scholars, they don't really know. I mean, it's a best guess, right? So
right, it's not like there's a phonetical spelling guide. You know, you meet someone today and they have a perfectly reasonably spelled name and then they let you know they pronounce it in some sort of idiosyncratic way. Like, who knows? Maybe Alcibiades was like, sorry, the C is silent. We don't know.
Exactly. So we'll have our best guess and we'll go from there.
I think Seneca would say it doesn't matter if you get the superficial stuff right. What matters is, do you get the essence of the person right? He talks about this as far as the Odyssey goes. You know, he says it doesn't matter whether it happened or it didn't happen or it was this year or that year. What matters is that you are navigating your own Odyssey.
Yeah, exactly right. That's another reason why sometimes I am puzzled by all of these discussions about, let's see, you know, try to find out the real historical Socrates and what he actually said. Well, I mean, we know that that's a lost cause. We're not going to find the historical Socrates. What's important is the Socrates, the character that has come to us from Plato, Xenophon, etc. What does that person tell us? And, you know, how we react to what that person tells us. The real thing, it's a chimera. It's like, who knows?
Yeah, what matters is that a lot of people thousands of years ago thought he was real, and almost all of Western thought is predicated on the idea of him being real, and what sort of timeless lessons are given within his life, or the fables about his life.
That's exactly right.
So let's go to Alcibiades. Like, what's his deal? Because I think to me, like, he's more confusing than Socrates himself. He's this, like, enigmatic, contradictory, brilliant, idiotic, heroic, villainous guy. And so many more things.
Yeah, he's really puzzling. In fact, one of the reasons originally I got interested in this project was precisely because I've always been fascinated by Alcibiades. And I'm still surprised that nobody, as far as I know, has made a movie out of his life, because, you know, that is definitely the kind of life that would deserve its own movie or even its own miniseries at this point. I mean, the guy was impossibly handsome, uber rich, brave, dashing. It was like everything you would want in a young man. And at the same time, incredibly flawed, right? He was a friend of Socrates, a student of Socrates, sometimes rumored to be lover or wannabe lover of Socrates. And yet, it's hard to imagine somebody who had a more negative impact on the history of ancient Athens than Alcibiades. I mean, he really made a mess out of his life and the life of his compatriots.
Do you think that's why Socrates liked him so much? He's like the puzzle of puzzles. we know Socrates liked puzzles. Was Alcibiades like the ultimate project? He had all the potential. He had all the flaws. Socrates doesn't seem to gravitate towards easy and simple questions. And definitely this guy wouldn't have been that kind of pupil.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Alcibiades was part of a broader project that that Socrates has. At least if we read Xenophon's Memorabilia, we find a version of Socrates who thinks of himself as in the business, at least in part, of advising people whether to get into politics or not. For instance, in the Memorabilia, he advises Glaucon, Plato's brother, not to get into politics, and Glaucon apparently listens to Socrates. And then he also invites Charmides, who was Glaucon's son, to get into politics because Socrates thought that Charmides was the right person. Charmides does, unfortunately, really bad timing because he gets into politics during the period of the 30 tyrants. So that didn't go out very well. Socrates also advises another individual, Euthydemus. In that case, also, Euthydemus listens to Socrates and realizes that he doesn't have what it takes to get into politics, and instead he becomes one of Socrates' students. So it looks like Socrates really did think of himself as not getting into politics himself, but as is somebody who might be able to move things indirectly, let's say, by telling people, by asking people, you know, you should do, you should not do. In fact, in the Memorabilia itself, in book one, a sophist, Antiphon, criticizes Socrates for not getting into politics. And Socrates replies, "Well, how now, Antiphon? Should I play a more important part in politics by engaging them in them alone, or by taking pains to turn out as many competent politicians as possible?" So this is very conscious on Socrates' part. So you're right that Alcibiades might have been part of this broader project, and probably Socrates was particularly interested in Alcibiades precisely because it was so challenging, right? It was so difficult to do.
So Socrates sees himself as this groomer of talent, this cultivator of potential, and Alcibiades has an unlimited amount of it, but it's also simultaneously this lost cause, it seems to me.
Exactly. Now, the thing is, Alcibiades is often brought up as an example of Socrates' failure, right? But I don't think that's quite fair, because Socrates actually tells Alcibiades not to do it. You know, when in the Alcibiades Maier, it's a dialogue attributed to Plato, although we're not sure that Plato wrote it or not. But nevertheless, in the dialogue, it's pretty clear. A young Alcibiades goes to Socrates and say, "Hey, I'm trying to, you know, I'm thinking of getting into politics. I want to become a leader in Athens. What do you think?" And then what follows is a brutal job interview, basically, by Socrates. And at the end, Socrates says explicitly to Alcibiades, he says, "Then, alas, Alcibiades, what a condition you suffer from. I hesitate to name it, but it must be said, you are wedded to stupidity, best of men, of the most extreme sort, as the argument accuses you and you accuse yourself. So this is why you are leaping into the affairs of the city before you've been educated." So Socrates is definitely telling Alcibiades, don't do it. It's not really Socrates' fault if then Alcibiades ignores the advice and goes and make a mess anyway.
Well, you know, you talk a lot about virtue at the beginning of the book, and I thought maybe a good place to start would be, are there any virtues that Alcibiades has, any of the virtues? Which one would you pin on him? I guess maybe courage, but he also strikes me as kind of a classic example of a type that's popular today. He's very smart, very able, very slick, you know, very ambitious and all these things. But what's missing, it seems like, is any sort of real moral compass or a set of ethics.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. In fact, the key there is the word you just used, moral. Right, as you know, the word virtue in Greek is arete, which just means, generally speaking, excellence. Now, clearly, Alcibiades does show excellence in a number of things. He's an excellent general, for one thing. He's later on in the Peloponnesian War, when he's reinstated as one of Athens' leaders, he brings about one victory after another. I mean, the guy is obviously a military genius. So he does have military excellence. He's also excellent, if you want to use that word, at a number of other things. Survival, for one thing. I mean, yes, at the end, spoiler alert, he does get killed. But he avoids a number of different kinds of enemies for decades throughout his life. So he does have certain kinds of excellences, but the ones that he's missing are the moral ones. He's certainly not courageous in the moral sense of the term. He's brave in battle, but he's not courageous in the moral sense. He's not temperate in the moral sense or in any other sense, really. He's not just, and he definitely is lacking in terms of practical wisdom. He doesn't know what is really good and what is really not good for him and for Athens.
Yeah, I guess Aristotle, looking at Alcibiades, would have pointed out how often he veered towards recklessness. Not only was it not in pursuit of the right thing, which I think we should talk about the sort of moral definition of courage, but it was so often not just taking risks, potentially catastrophic risks, the consequences of which were borne by other people. So, I mean, often Alcibiades' courage is sort of an intemperate vice.
That's right. That's exactly right. I mean, the guy is lucky for a couple of decades of his life, right? I mean, he gets away with things that other people would have been killed or at any rate, certainly not succeeded. Eventually, of course, his luck does run out, as Seneca would have alerted us, right? It's like, you can't count on luck for your entire life. At some point, it will turn against you. And that's where you see the real fiber of a real person capable of handling the virtues. If you are virtuous, then the fact that luck turns against you, it's not a big deal. But if you are already counting on luck in order to make your life and not on your virtues, then that's the end of the game. And sure enough, that's what happens to Alcibiades.
So you brought up this idea that simple bravery is not the same as the cardinal virtue of courage. Walk me through that distinction.
So one can show bravery in the face of, let's say, physical danger, regardless of what that physical danger is, and especially regardless of why that person thinks that this is necessary, right? The morally courageous person, on the other hand, braves consequences of his actions or her actions only when they are in fact morally salient. So it's a question of you expose yourself to danger, or you expose yourself to consequences of your negative consequences to your actions because it's the right thing to do, as opposed to because you want to impress somebody or because you want to show off or because of all sorts of other reasons. And a lot of I don't know that it is fair to say a lot, but a certain number of instances of what people consider courage falls instead into these kind of, I'm going to show you how brave I am. I'm going to show you how I can face danger, even though there is no particular reason to do it, or in fact, even worse, when there is a bad reason to do it, right? A non-moral reason to do it.
Right. I've always said, like, a non-controversial example of this would be like riding a motorcycle without a helmet. It requires facing of danger and death, but why?
That's exactly. Right. So you're there possibly risking your life to make what point exactly? That you're stupid enough to risk it for no particular reason. There's also immoral bravery, right? So there are, imagine a terrorist or a soldier for that matter who espouses the wrong cause and blows himself up or puts himself in danger in order, let's say, I'm sure there were brave Nazi soldiers during World War II, but there were...
Confederacy is a good example.
Yeah, exactly, or the Confederacy. They were fighting for a morally questionable, if not downright awful reason, and therefore that doesn't make him courageous in the sense of one of the cardinal virtues, but they're still brave.
No, I think a lot of people got that wrong during the pandemic also. I'm going to say this unpopular thing and I'm willing to get canceled for it. But what matters to me, I think, is number one, is it correct, right? Because the virtue of wisdom's in there too. But also, as you said, like, where is it in terms of the concept of justice or our obligations to other people? So saying like, hey, I don't care about getting a virus or something like that, I guess you're waving off of potential danger. But if by nature of your personal choice, you endanger other people needlessly, or you take up a spot in a hospital or whatever, you're not only not being the moral virtue of courage, but you're also in violation of the other virtue, which would be justice.
That's right. And I think that's why Socrates and the Stoics defended the notion of the unity of virtues, right? So this idea that, yes, we can name different virtues, the four cardinal ones, which then are actually subdivided into further, you know, details. But in reality, all of these are actually aspects of the same fundamental thing, which you can refer to as wisdom, so generally speaking, right? Precisely, that's precisely why, because you cannot be courageous without being also just and temperate and having practical wisdom. If you have only one of those or only two of those, then you run into the, you know, you run the risk of putting yourself in danger for no particularly good reason, or even worse, for a bad reason.
No, you have a good point. The virtues are inextricably intertwined. And I think it was Euripides was saying, you know, that the presence of injustice immediately renders any of the other virtues worthless.
Exactly. Exactly. And that wouldn't make any sense unless you thought of the virtues either as I said, aspects of the same underlying thing, or as you say, as very deeply intertwined. You just can't separate them. It's like quarks in fundamental physics. In theory, they're different and they're separate things, but in reality, you've never seen them apart. You can't pull them apart.
Okay. So let me ask you, as someone who isn't an expert in the classics and certainly has little familiarity with Latin and Greek, that's me, what is the difference between virtue and arete? They're synonyms, but I mean, I guess they wouldn't have separate words if they fundamentally meant the same thing.
Right, they don't, that's exactly right. And it is something that is not appreciated, I think, by a number of people. They're not the same thing. Virtue, as we understand it, is a subcategory of arete. So arete is the general concept, is, as we were saying before, excellence in the broad sense. I mean, when Aristotle says a knife can have arete if it cuts well, if it does its proper function, if it carries out its proper function well, clearly he's not talking about a moral virtue, right? You know, knives don't have moral virtues. And yet he uses, right, and yet he uses the same word that then he later on applies to the moral virtues. So I think a good way to think of it is that arete, excellence, is the broader concept, which can apply to anything or anyone that has a proper function. And in fact, it is defined as carrying out that proper function correctly at a high level. But then there is the crucial subset of arete, which has to do with the moral virtues, and that's the one that we're usually concerned with when we talk about virtue. But you could, if you take virtue as a simple translation of arete, then you are just using the generic word, and that not necessarily the moral one. And so you might need to qualify it and say make a distinction between moral virtues and virtue more broadly construed.
That's a really interesting thing, because it's like too many people pursue arete without virtue. So just excellence, no virtue. And then I think you could argue there are people who, you know, spiritual practitioners, monks, sages, etc., or what have you, they explore virtue and they dedicate themselves to it, but they lack the attribute of arete or excellence, you might say, the ability to act on that, to bring it into the world, to do something. I don't think specifically to the Stoics, but this idea that being virtuous on paper or one's personal practice was, it's like not fully achieving your potential as a human being. You had to be virtuous. You had to have arete in the public sphere in life. Is that where they come together?
I agree. In fact, here's one way to think about the issue. So I think that the moral virtues are inherently social. They're inherently public. And one way to understand that, I think, or appreciate that, is if we go back to the basics and we look at the origins of the very words that we use when we talk about morality or ethics. So for the Greco-Romans, ethics and morality meant exactly the same thing, right? Ethics came from the Greek ethos, and morality from the Latin moralis, which is simply as the way in which Cicero translates ethos. So it's exactly the same thing. Sometimes nowadays, modern philosophers try to make some distinction between morality and ethics. But as far as the Greco-Romans are concerned, we're talking about exactly the same thing. Now, both words have to do with character and with community in both cases. And so right there, if you go just at the etymology of the word, what it means to practice the moral or ethical virtues is that you're practicing a kind of excellence that is other regarding. It's not about you. You can't do it in a monastery. You can't do it as an hermit. You can't do it on a deserted island. It's inherently a social thing, because after all, what is ethics in the first place? It's the problem. It's a study of how to solve the problem, or how to live harmoniously with other human beings. That's what we're talking about. And so it is inherently other directed.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that. Like, let's say you're thinking about a politician, because obviously that's Socrates thought a lot about that. If you want a politician who's great, who's disciplined, who is just, cares about the common good, who's wise. But to go to the idea of erete, if this person is, although virtuous and good, like they're a bumbling, incompetent politician or an uncharismatic politician, it doesn't really matter. At least something to be desired. Maybe we talk about Cato a little bit. I mean, Cato's a good example of that. He's a politician, right? But in some ways, it's just as if his overwhelming sense of virtue
right.
constrains him or limits him. He's like so often steadfast, he's so firm that he's paralyzed, right? And I guess, I don't know, it's interesting to me. Virtue is obviously important, but if you can't do the job, like let's say I'm philosophically the wisest person who ever lived, but then I sat down to write and I'm just boring or self-indulgent, what does it really matter?
You're absolutely right. In fact, I begin the sixth chapter of the book of The Quest for Character with an interesting quote, one of my favorite quotes really from the ancient authors. It's from Cicero, who was very much a practical philosopher, meaning that he was not only a philosopher, but a politician, you know, a statesman, etc. And in fact, in that quote, he's writing to his lifelong friend Atticus, and he's talking about Cato. Now, Cato, of course, as you know, is a role model for Stoics and, you know, high level of integrity, et cetera, et cetera. But as you were saying, too much and too inflexible for actually being an effective politician. And Cicero complains about Cato to his friend Atticus. He says, "As for our friend Cato, you do not love him more than I do. But after all, with the very best intentions and the most absolute honesty, he sometimes does harm to the Republic. He speaks and votes as though he were in the Republic of Plato, not in the scum of Romulus." I love that phrase, right? The scum of Romulus. And that's exactly right. I mean, in fact, my next project, which I'm going to start next year, I'm going to be on sabbatical, is on Cicero, precisely for that reason, because I think Cicero is one of the very few examples in antiquity of not only somebody who took philosophy at heart very seriously. He tried to practice both in his public life and in his personal life his chosen philosophy, but he was a politician. He was a lawyer. He actually, in one of his books, he criticizes Socrates. He says, you know, Socrates is my role model, but the thing is, Socrates did not appreciate rhetoric. He said, you know, Socrates, in fact, was downright distrustful of rhetoric. He thought that if you engage in rhetoric, you're a sophist. You're trying to manipulate other people. And Cicero says that means he was not as effective as he could have been, because you need to understand how to talk to other people, how to persuade other people, of course, with the right intentions, right? So you have to have right intentions, but right intentions by themselves are not going to do it. You're going to turn yourself into a Cato, who was, yes, very high level of integrity, but also very inefficient as a politician.
There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at Progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Well, you have a great case study and a character study of Marcus Aurelius in the book, which I really liked. Because one of my favorite quotes in Meditations, you know, Marcus goes, "Don't go around expecting Plato's Republic." I think he was having to learn a lesson there from Cato, or specifically that line from Cicero, although we don't know if he actually said it or not. I think he was saying, look, you're the emperor of Rome, which is a real place in the real world in a real flawed time. I don't think that's all out pragmatism, but he is trying to like dispense with the fantasy and projection and naivete, which sometimes a virtuous person, you know, just unconsciously adopts and then wonders why they're not able to get the world from where it is a little bit closer to where they want it to be.
Yeah, exactly. So now you picked on Marcus as an example. Marcus is yet another instance like Cicero, right? He's certainly informed by his philosophy. His life is certainly devoted to his philosophy, in particular to Stoicism. But he's a politician. He has to get things done. He's a general in the field. He has to get things done. And so those are, I think, the most interesting examples, because you mentioned the word pragmatism. These are Cicero and Marcus, both are very pragmatic people, but they are virtuously pragmatic, as opposed to, let's say, a Machiavelli, who was an anti-virtuously pragmatic, right? And in fact, it's not by chance that Machiavelli, who I actually mentioned a little bit later on near the end of the book, Machiavelli took himself to be responding to Cicero, not to Socrates. Right? Because he realized that Cicero was the opposite, in a sense, of what what Machiavelli was trying to do. Both of them pragmatic, but one thought that you can be pragmatic. There is no contradiction in being pragmatic and at the same time trying to be virtuous. While on the other hand, Machiavelli had arrived at the conclusion based on his own environment and culture that no, the two are incompatible. It's one or the other. You can't have both.
Yeah, it's a delightful oxymoron there, and not unlike the Stoics' favorite of preferred indifference. I'm writing about Gandhi right now, and I didn't have that word, so I'm going to use it now. So thanks. But he's this remarkable character in that he's preposterously idealistic and pure, and he believes in these almost impossible things. Yet, as a politician, he's like constantly compromising, negotiating. It's always on the assumption that we're getting closer and closer to the ideal, but he wasn't compromising the fundamental principle that was at stake, but he was willing to settle for a crumb, another crumb, and then another crumb, which I do think Cato struggled with. He had this idea of like how the republic should work, and then he insisted on that price, refusing to compromise in any way, which, as Plutarch observes, ends up bringing about the very collapse he said he was trying to prevent.
Exactly. That's why in the quote from Marcus that you mentioned earlier, Marcus says, you know, be content with making progress here. And now he says, because it matters. Because you are, if you make progress right now, you have to have an ideal in mind. I mean, that's the reason why there is, in fact, no long-term contradiction between virtue and pragmatism. Because if by pragmatism you simply mean I'm going to get things done no matter what, and I don't even know what exactly I want to get done except that I want to solve the problem right now, well, then sure. But you can go in that direction, and you're definitely not going to go into virtuous direction. But then the idea of having an ideal in mind, so you know where you're going to go. You have a compass. You have a moral compass. But at the same time, you are pragmatic in the sense that you realize that you might never get there. And certainly, you're not going to get there right here, right now, because there's a lot of other stuff that you need to get done. And you have to convince people who might not share the same vision, or perhaps who share the same vision but don't share your same ideas of how to get to implement that vision. And so what are you going to do? Are you going to do things so that you are getting incrementally close to that ideal that you have in mind, or you're just going to be, uncompromising and then risk losing the whole thing, which is exactly what happened to Cato.
Yes. I mean, speaking of senators, I was thinking of this bill that just passed or was in the process of passing in the U.S. where they're trying to defend gay and interracial marriage, which at the time, because the Democrats didn't have the votes and the Supreme Court is, you know, whatever, they had to find a way to get 10 or so people that they disagreed with on almost everything to come to their side and make the deal. And Chuck Schumer makes the deal where he agrees to table the legislation until after the midterms. He has to take them at their word, and then he has to put a bunch of protections that, you know, are probably not preferred, that shouldn't be on the table. We shouldn't have to be negotiating for something as straightforward and sort of basic as people's ability to marry who they want to marry. And yet, you know, we don't live in the Republic, right? We live in America in 2022, which is, if not quite the dregs of Romulus, you know, it's not perfect. And if not doing that, you know, brings about something worse in the opposite direction. You know, if the Democrats lose the Senate or the Supreme Court ruling down comes here or there, you know, by despairing of perfection and deciding to compromise, they're avoiding a potential worse alternative.
Yeah, I completely agree. And that is, it's the approach of let's get whatever we can get done now in going in the right direction, because you can always go back and revisit it later. Once you have moved one or two or three steps in the right direction, now it's actually making it more difficult for your opponent to push back. Sometimes, of course, they will push back, and they will push back successfully. See the overturning of Roe v. Wade, for instance, right? We thought that was done decades ago, but apparently it wasn't.
Although, you know, if the Democrats had made some compromise along the way and codified some sort of federal minimum, they wouldn't have been exposed the way they were. And maybe it's, I don't know, pick your poison. It's fascinating.
Yeah. Now, it's the fundamental notion here is that, which is in effect, one of the messages that I'm trying to get through in the book, is that if you decide to get into politics, into statesmanship, then you have to do two things. You have to do it with a moral compass in mind, because otherwise you become a ruthless, self-serving narcissist like Alcibiades. So you have to have the moral compass, but at the same time, you have to realize, as Cicero says, and as Marcus say, that we don't live in Plato's Republic, and we're much closer to the mud of Romulus. And you need to take that into account. Otherwise, you're going to be completely frustrated and not only inefficient, but in fact, arguably causing problems yourself in a direction that you really didn't want to.
Well, you think even about Socrates. When people think of Socrates, they think of this golden age of Athens and this sort of wonderful place, and they don't realize that even Socrates himself existed, you know, in the time of the 30 tyrants. Not one tyrant, 30. And so I think, you know, even his view must have been tempered by a certain kind of pragmatism or realism. But by the nature of the world, he woke up and he had to live in that every day.
Yeah. However, that's one of the reasons, as we were saying at the beginning of this conversation, that may be one reason why Socrates deliberately chose not to get into politics himself and instead thought, look, my best chance to affect the events here is to talk to people and to influence people indirectly, right? So, and that's a very valuable choice. I mean, you know, I myself have made essentially the same kind of choice, right? I decided to become a teacher, not a politician. Now, I'm very interested in politics, and I talk to my students about politics all the time, and we have interesting, you know, discussions that sometimes become uncomfortable for either the students or myself. But that's the point. I know myself enough to know that I would be a disaster as a politician. I just don't have the skills. I don't have the rhetoric. And more importantly, I don't have the ability to compromise and the ability to be diplomatic that a real politician has to have in order to be efficacious. But I can teach. And I can teach, I think, if I flatter myself a little bit, you know, fairly efficiently. So I can have that kind of influence. Each one of us, I think there is a general lesson there. Each one of us can contribute positively to society, especially if we realize, if we know ourselves, you know, the famous Delphic Oracle injunction, right? Know thyself. If we know ourselves enough to figure out what kinds of things we can actually be efficacious and in pursuing, and what are the things we need to stay away from, because we're not, you know, it'd be nice to be able to do it, but that's just not me. And so I might as well not go in the directions that are going to be deleterious or inefficacious. You know, I need to focus my energy and my time on things that I think are going to work, going to make a contribution.
You know, it's interesting though, almost all the character studies in the book, you have Socrates, Alcibiades, Aristotle, and Alexander, you have Seneca and Nero, Marcus and Commodus, it like never works. In almost none of the examples, are they able to teach virtue to the person, or were they able to be the adult in the room that steers them in the right direction?
Yeah, I think that you know, the two chapters there that are interesting, make an interesting contrast are 5 and 6. In chapter 5, I talk about instances of philosophers wanted to be teaching virtue to politicians. And in 6, I talk about politicians themselves who are already prone to philosophy and seek advice from philosophers. And the contrast is pretty remarkable, because almost every case of philosophers who try to influence politicians who are not interested are failures. I mean, Plato failed twice with Dionysus I and Dionysus II of Syracuse, and he almost lost his life on both occasions, right? Aristotle did a little bit better with Alexander. Seneca was a disaster with Nero, and so on. When is it that it works? It works when people like Marcus or Cicero or Dion, who was a student of Plato, because those are the people that actually seek out the philosophers for advice, right? So it's a very different, it's a specific example of the general notion that you can teach people, but you cannot learn on behalf of people. They have to do the learning themselves. So if they're not willing to learn, if they're not willing to accept advice, it's just not going to work. Which is why I think at the end of the day, the advice at the end of the book is twofold, you know, because the question is, you know, how do we improve the situation in terms of statesmanship and in terms of our politicians? And I think that at the end of the day, we need to do two things. One, get rid of most of the politicians we have now, because frankly, they're not interested in virtue and in doing the right thing. Not all of them, of course, there's always exceptions, but we need to get rid of a bunch of people. And, you know, in countries like the United States that are more or less democratic, you can do that, because at the end of the day, these people are in charge. Yeah, in charge because we vote them, right? So at the end of the day, we can do that. The other thing then we need to do is invest in the long run. And we're not doing this. In other words, teaching virtue to our kids, young kids, you know, like elementary school or middle school level kids. And we just don't do that. In fact, we do it so rarely that recently I saw a documentary about one of the few exceptions. So this is a movie called Young Plato. And it is set in an elementary school, in a Catholic elementary school in Belfast, Northern Ireland. And it's the story of, the real story, because it's a documentary, of the school's principal who decides to teach philosophy to his kids, practical philosophy to his kids. And even though he uses a broad, you know, number of philosophers in his teachings, mostly, and not surprisingly, he keeps going back to Socrates and the Stoics, because they tend to be the most practical ones. And you see the impact, that the specific impact and direct impact of philosophy on these kids. These are kids that have to deal with bullying, of course. That's a common phenomenon. They are, remember, in Belfast, so they're growing up in a society that is still marred by violence and by strife and so on and so forth. So they have to deal with this stuff in real life, and they benefit from philosophy. But we don't do that. We don't teach philosophy in that sense to our kids. In fact, quite the opposite. We try to stay away as much as possible from it. And then we complain, why is it that the next generation of people is not, you know, it's coming up and we don't have good leaders? Well, no kidding.
Well, yeah, you think of Nero. Seneca is someone who was forced upon Nero. And I think that famous statue of Seneca teaching Nero, you know, he's not very interested. You could read his body language. And then, you know, you contrast that with Marcus, who had this really very early predilection towards philosophy. You know, although he's adopted by Antoninus, he accepts Antoninus as his stepfather. He seeks out Rusticus, who he sees as his teacher. He's not unwilling, right? And you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. That's really the difference. It doesn't matter how smart the teacher is. Like, if you're not interested in learning, putting those ideas into practice, doesn't matter.
Right. And you foster listening and interest in those ideas much earlier. You know, Nero was already 17 by the time that Seneca got to him. Had it been a different person, it might have worked. I mean, with Alexander, it did work to some extent. And Alexander was about the same age as Nero. But at that point, it's a crapshoot. It depends on what kind of territory, you know, you find. Is it fertile or is it not? But if you come in much earlier, at the beginning of what the Greco-Romans used to refer to as the age of reason, so when a kid is 7 or 8 years old, when modern developmental psychology tells us that's the time when children start being able to engage in abstract thinking, for instance, right? That is the time to intervene, and yet we don't do it, and then we complain about it.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now. Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. It's always sensitive talking about these things, but Hims is changing men's healthcare by providing access to doctor-trusted ED treatments such as chewable hard mints, brand name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and 100% online. No uncomfortable doctor's visits. If prescribed, your medication ships to you for free. No insurance needed. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/TDS. That's hims.com/TDS for your personalized ED treatment options. Hard mints are a chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with your healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. Yeah, I wrote these two kids' books about Stoicism. Like, you're not going to teach kids these ideas with books about talking pizza, you know, or whatever. Like, cartoon characters are great, but right. I think there's a reason that for most of human history, we're taught Aesop's fables, or we're taught the moral stories, the 300 Spartans. It doesn't really matter if it's strictly true, or whether the Odyssey was literal, whether the ideas in the Bible are true. Like, what matters is the parables that they're illustrating and demonstrating. They're trying to teach and inculcate lessons that stick with you. So that, yeah, in some big scenario, you go, let he who is without sin cast the first stone, and whatever it is. You would have the reminder, the precept, as the Stoics would say, that would stick with you. So when you counted, you had like a guide.
Exactly. I mean, it's interesting that you mentioned the Bible and the Odyssey. So on the one hand, in terms of the Bible, I spent 9 years of my career as an academic in Tennessee. And at the time, I was an evolutionary biologist. So you can imagine what kind of cultural environment I found myself in. And I had a hard time trying to talk to people and say, look, you're so obsessed with this notion that everything that the Bible says has to be factually correct. You're missing the point. That isn't the point. The point is the story. It's the moral of the story. It doesn't matter whether it is factually correct or not. Just think about ancient mythology, which was obviously not factually correct. That was clearly not the point. When I was a kid, one of the major books that influenced me was precisely the Odyssey. You know, I saw Odysseus as such a fascinating character, you know, smart and wily and, you know, and courageous in a sense. In the end,
flawed.
Flawed, of course, because he's a human being, right? So that, but I never took that, the Odyssey, for a moment as a history textbook. You know, I never thought that Scylla and Charybdis are actual things, you know, beasts outside in the Strait of Messina in Sicily or anything like that. So it's the attitude really should be one of what is the moral lesson here that I'm learning, that I'm supposed to be learned from the story. I mean, think about another example that you mentioned earlier, Plutarch. You know, you cannot take the lives of Plutarch as necessarily historically accurate as we would want a biography, let's say, to be. They're not. He tells us in at the beginning of the entry on Alexander, he tells you that he's not about to tell you all of the single battles and all of the single things that happened. That's not his interest. His interest is in the character, both the flaws and the good things about people's characters. So it's a different kind of, it's a different way of looking at things, and therefore a different way of reading things. If you read Plutarch as verbatim history, you're completely mistaken. You're completely missing the point.
Well, it's funny. Modern biographers seem to fancy themselves as like superior to Plutarch because they care about scholarly sources or accuracy or facts or numbers. And they're missing, I think, like the only reason the Stoics would say you should study a biography, which is how to learn how to be a great man or woman, or to learn what not to do as a great man or woman. And Plutarch makes the point, he says, like, look at what this general did, you know, in the most momentous point of battle. It's like, that's way less important than this offhanded remark or what they may or may not have even done, but like was said to illustrate or demonstrate their character, their essence as a person. And you could probably make the same argument for Diogenes Laertius and Lives of the Eminent Philosophers. Like, so much of what he's saying is obviously preposterous, just demonstrably not true, but it was designed, I think, to get to the essence of what made that person tick.
Exactly. And that's another thing that Diogenes Laertius in particular, it's another thing that really baffles me every time that I read a commentary or an introduction to Diogenes, because of course you're being told that, hey, you know, you shouldn't take what you read here as historical truth because Diogenes, you know, we don't know his sources and he made up a few stories. Right. But if you're trying to separate the reality from the fiction, you're again missing the point. I mean, in some cases, not only there are instances in Diogenes where it's, as you say, it's very obvious that stuff is made up or it's impossible or stuff, but in a number of cases, he gives you two or three different versions of the death of the same person, right? So it's clear that it doesn't mean that as historical accuracy. It's like, yeah, it's one guy says that Zeno died this way, another guy says he died the other way. That's not the point. The point is the moral message. And we need to really pay more, relearn, I guess, to pay more attention to the moral message. Because at the end of the day, history, you know, I find history itself, of course, fascinating. You know, it does have intrinsic value. And you know, I think it is certainly worth pursuing. But at the end of the day, if we are into practical philosophy, we want to pay attention to things in a way that makes us better human beings and that makes for a better society. And you're not going to do that if you try to pinpoint exactly what happened or what did not happen in any specific example.
Okay, let me pull, there's this quote from Seneca I like. What did he say? Sorry, I'm trying to pull it out of Lives of the Stoics. I have it here. Basically, he says, yeah, the only purpose of studying philosophy is to make you a better human being. That's why I opened the book. I love it. The idea is that philosophy is supposed to make you a better human being, not to get the appreciation of big, confusing words like we're talking about. It's not riddles or tractable questions, but I think you get the same argument about history and biography in any subject, maybe not mathematics or whatever. But the purpose of studying this thing is to come up with rules and insight for the conduct of human affairs, not to dazzle with how brilliant your mind is.
Yeah, and one of the sad things, of course, these days is that if you're interested in philosophy from a practical perspective, in terms of improving your life and society at large, the last place you want to be is in the philosophy department, unfortunately, right? I think to some extent that is changing a little bit. It's changing because of this resurgence of not just Stoicism, but practical philosophy in general. It is changing because the academia itself is changing and philosophy departments find themselves under threat of being closed or shrunk down significantly. And so they realize, finally, they're beginning to realize that they need to be relevant to their students' lives. And so slowly, and besides, of course, the new generations are used to begin to, use, to be used to a different way of thinking. And so things may be changing. But right now, and certainly for the last 50 years or at least, you know, if you were interested in the meaning of life and how to know thyself, you don't go into a philosophy department because that's you're wasting your time.
I forget who said it, but I thought it was brilliant. They were talking about the Stoics. He was listing all the philosophers that were banished or this emperor or that emperor put them to death. And he said, like, if a tyrant returned to power today, they wouldn't even bother banishing philosophers. Like what philosophers would they feel they needed to persecute? Because it doesn't matter. It's just totally masturbatory or pointless or on some other level is totally non-threatening. There are people they would persecute. It just wouldn't be the philosophers.
That's right. It would be comedians.
Probably.
These days, I think it would be mostly comedians.
Sure.
And that's a sad statement. I mean, it's good for comedy, but it's a bad statement for philosophy. You know, it used to be in ancient Greece and Rome that both philosophers and comedians were persecuted by tyrants, right? I mean, we tend to think in our conversations, we tend to talk about people like Socrates and Marcus Aurelius and so on. But there were people like Aristophanes, for instance. And those were people who also got themselves in trouble for speaking truth to power. And these days, we do not have that. We have very few intellectuals that actually get into that that mode of operation. And usually those intellectuals are not philosophers. We need to change that. So it's one interesting, good project for humanity to bring back intellectuals outside of the so-called ivory tower, especially if they're philosophers, because they have a lot to contribute to society and to practical life, if only they bothered to do it.
Yeah, I mean, your point about comedians is well taken. You know, a comedian is not bound by the rules of reality. They can blur fact and fiction, but the spirit of what they say is true, and it's probably why it's dangerous.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, we go back to Plato, and you read one of the Platonic dialogues, talk about blending reality with fiction. I mean, Plato came up with some of the most interesting and fascinating myths, like, you know, the lost Atlantis, for instance, or
the allegory of the cave.
Yes, the cave, or the myth in the Symposium, which he attributes to Aristophanes, actually about the origin of love and you know why we look for our twin souls and so on. Those are all stories that, of course, were not meant to be taken literally. There's no question about it. But there was a message there, and the message was delivered through the story. That's why I think that these days, you know, in contemporary culture, comedians, especially philosophically informed comedians, that one of the interesting things is that a lot of comedians actually have degrees in philosophy, as it turns out, have a background in philosophy. And I don't think that's by chance. It seems to be the last time I looked into it, it seemed to be a higher number than, you know, higher percentage than you would expect by chance.
No, interesting. I mean, okay, as we wrap up, the last thing I thought that's maybe we're talking about here as we talk about philosophy, I remember we were at Stoicon, and one of the things we were talking about was the popularity of Stoicism. And I know you're not strictly a Stoic, you're sort of fusing Stoicism and skepticism in a couple of schools, but it does strike me as really interesting that the popularity of, say, Buddhism versus Stoicism, even though we live in the Western world, you could argue that these fundamental bedrock philosophical schools and their teachings aren't nearly as popular as they could be, should be. And there's probably a lot left to be done in teaching and popularizing this.
There is a lot to be done. I think that it would be really good if we were able to push Stoicism and Greco-Roman philosophy to the level, let's say, of Buddhism worldwide. Even Buddhism is not really a majority, you know, it's not the largest religion or philosophy in the world, but certainly counts a good number of followers, and it is influential. And if over time we were able to push some of these revised, of course, updated, because that's always what you need to do. I mean, you know, modern Buddhism is not the same as Buddhism 2,000 years ago. So it's fine to update and revise and all that sort of stuff. But I really do think that one of the major values in my mind of Stoicism is precisely that it is potentially the Western equivalent of Buddhism, and it deserves to be up there in terms of usefulness for a lot of people. So we have a lot of work to do before we get to that level, but I don't see why not.
Let's do it. Massimo, thank you very much. This was awesome.
Let's continue to do it.
Thanks so much for listening. If you could rate this podcast and leave a review on iTunes, that would mean so much to us and it would really help the show. We appreciate it, and I'll see you next episode. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Guy Raz's How I Built This is a podcast where each week he talks to the founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you hear these entrepreneurs really go into their story. And Guy is an incredible interviewer. He doesn't just dance around the surface. He has real questions because he himself is an entrepreneur. He's built this huge show and this huge company. In a recent episode, they talked to the founder of Liquid Death, that crazy water company that's become this billion-dollar brand. Follow the show on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. And for a deep dive in daily business content, listen to Wondery V. Destination for Business podcasts with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.